This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we hear from a 12-year-old Kalamazoo boy who was arrested earlier this month in Washington, D.C. Esteban Vertigo was among a group that gathered outside the office of House Speaker John Boehner calling for immigration reform. But first, the name and voice of journalist and author Ray Suarez is very familiar to public radio audiences. He was the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation and the monthly program America Abroad. Last year, Suarez left the PBS NewsHour after 14 years and joined Al Jazeera America. I spoke with Suarez earlier this month, shortly before he gave the commencement address at Kalamazoo College. When I asked what advice he may have for students thinking about a career in journalism, Suarez said that, half-jokingly, he advises students to have a really good plan B.
I love this work. I always have. I love it even when I hate it. And the hours are tough, and if you're someone who values regularity and routine, predictability, stability in your domestic life, this may not be for you.
But Suarez says young people getting into journalism now have to be ready for a profession that is radically changing. He says it's impossible to know what the industry will look like when people now in their 20s are in the middle of their careers.
I would never try to discourage people who really think they have a desire for it, but it's going to be a very different business moving ahead, but in ways that I can't predict yet, because right now we're tearing apart and rebuilding a transcontinental jet at 35,000 feet somewhere over the Midwest. It's hair-raising. The whole business model of how we sustain a news business and how we pay the people who work in it is under assault and being radically rethought as we're doing it.
Ray Suarez is the host of Al Jazeera America's Inside Story. Ray Suarez, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
Why don't we talk a little bit about your decision to go from the NewsHour to Al Jazeera America? What went into that?
Well, after 14 years at the NewsHour, I had to really think about what the future would hold for me there and strip away all the sentiment, strip away my very real affection for my colleagues there and the people I had helped build the show with over the years. And I just didn't see much out there. If I stayed for 3 years or 5 years or even longer, I didn't see much improvement in my position. The finances of the NewsHour are perilous. And as I tried to think about the latter part of my career, I just couldn't see myself there. And when you feel that way about a place, it's hard to square spending much more time there. So I started to look around.
And what brought you to Al Jazeera America? Why did you decide that was the place you wanted to be?
Well, Al Jazeera America is a startup, but it's a startup that's embedded in an established media institution. So it's got the best of both worlds, all the juice and spontaneity and inventiveness and willingness to try new things of a startup, and all the good things about an established place. Your business cards arrive in a box, the phone on your desk rings, the checks cash, and all of those things that are great about a place that's already got its systems in order and its procedures in place. So we are Al Jazeera America, a 24-hour news network seen just in the United States and meant to be a domestic competitor to MSNBC, Fox, and CNN.
What sort of things do you think viewers would see on Al Jazeera America, assuming they haven't had the opportunity to try it, that they would not see on CNN, MSNBC, or the Fox News Channel?
Well, if you like real news, you'll like Al Jazeera America. It's a serious place to do original reporting, in-depth and unbiased, and it really has no political agenda. Has no lens through which it regards the world. It's just a straight-ahead news organization. You're likely to see a lot more international coverage than I think the American services are doing, but also at the same time, a very careful attention to what's going on domestically. Al Jazeera America has opened bureaus all over the United States, so there are Al Jazeera America crews and correspondents everywhere, in the South, in the West, in the Midwest. We're the only one of the 24-hour news channels with a fully-fledged bureau in Detroit, another one in New Orleans, covering the evolving situation in those two cities and in the more predictable and usually well-staffed places like Los Angeles and Chicago and New York as well. So we're trying to cover the stories that everybody covers, but in a slightly different way, and also cover different stories from the ones that the big guys are covering right now.
I was talking with a family member recently who told me that Al Jazeera America had come on his cable system, and he turned it on and left it on and was waiting to pounce when he heard the objectionable content that he was expecting, and actually found out that he enjoyed it quite a bit and thought it was very well done. Do you get that reaction a lot? Do people have a reaction to the name Al Jazeera that perhaps is different from the reaction they have to what you actually report?
You bet. And it makes it a little more challenging to win people over because they come with preconceptions. They come to the act of watching television already with an assumption about a political agenda, a worldview that they're going to see expressed in the way we tell the stories and the stories that we tell. And they are pleasantly surprised for the most part. I mean, we do have market research that shows that if we show our content to prospective viewers without the Al Jazeera labeling on it, they almost unanimously enjoy what they see and retain what they see and really like the story selection, and then are surprised to find out that it's Al Jazeera America coverage. I think that's a strength going forward, that the product speaks for itself, that the product will sell itself once we can get people to give us a chance.
And is that the key to Al Jazeera America becoming that full-fledged competitor to the other cable news networks that you mentioned?
Absolutely. You know, CNN has had at several different junctures in its roughly 35-year existence big stories that drove everybody to the television. And those were considered the moments when CNN sort of cemented itself into the American news diet. When a couple of big stories happen in the world and people try us out, at those moments where people are saying, yeah, we got to turn on the news now, I think those will be the moments where our value will be demonstrated, where the perhaps negative expectations of prospective audience members won't be met, and they'll say, they'll walk away from the TV saying, no, I really got the news. I got the story well told, skillfully told, competently reported, in a challenging, straightforward manner. And if that's what I went to see, I got what I was looking for, so I'll come back to this place. We found that when we did our first ever State of the Union address, the numbers for a normal weeknight went up by 400% because it was one of those moments where millions of people who normally watch the State of the Union address use that as an opportunity to check out Al Jazeera America.
Your most recent book is Latinos, the 500-year history that shaped the nation. What was the most surprising thing that you came across as you were doing research, or maybe the thing that surprises readers the most when they pick this up?
The thing that I wanted to remind people in the most affirming way possible, not the way of, come on, everybody, you know, get with it. This has been a multicultural country since day one. This has been a country with a strong Latino presence since Columbus, but rather to invite people to rethink their idea, the idea that generations of schooling in the United States has given us, that America is an enterprise that begins at Plymouth Rock and at Jamestown and just moves west, this English-derived thing that ends up covering this whole continental-sized country, but that when the Pilgrims hadn't even arrived in Massachusetts yet, St. Augustine, Florida, was already a well-established Spanish-speaking city. When Jamestown was a struggling stockade on the muddy coasts of Virginia, Santa Fe was already the seat of a Spanish governor overseeing a colony. That when people are sitting in traffic on the I-5 between San Diego and Los Angeles, that San Diego and Los Angeles are named those two things because those were Spanish cities, part of the Spanish Empire, meant to extend both military and religious control up the Pacific coast of North America. These are things that should widen your arms and be encouraging you to wrap your arms around a more inclusive, more complicated view of the history of this continent, rather than a sort of cramped, English-only, exclusivist kind of idea. And through the whole 270 or so pages of the book, I try to gently remind the reader of how the Latino presence in North America is not some Johnny-come-lately thing with the people who just arrived the day before yesterday, but has been a long, formative, influential piece of American history always.
How does that history, or perhaps the misreading of that history, influence the way that we now view issues like, say, immigration?
Well, and if you have a healthy appetite for irony, you might roll your eyes a little bit the next time some Florida school district enters a protracted battle over the role of Spanish in the public schools. When Spanish has been spoken in Florida for centuries longer than English, you have to have that broader view of American history in order to understand the U.S. role in the world. Once we became the modern state that we are, roughly at the end of the 19th century, took over Puerto Rico, occupied Cuba, took the Philippines, that we became a place that not only sent soldiers and sailors out to the world, but took in people from the rest of the world, and that role has meant we were going to be a different kind of place. We weren't going to be an ethnically uniform, socially uniform, racially uniform. We were never going to be that kind of place. And so we've always had this very ambiguous relationship with ambivalent relationship with multiculturalism. Instead of just recognizing it as part of our DNA, we've given maybe on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we embrace it, and on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, we sort of push it away. It's a funny part of American history.
You've also wrote books that deal with sort of the overlap of religion and politics, as well as the issue of urban flight. What kind of makes a topic important enough to you where you say, I got to go beyond reporting it on television or radio. This needs a book to tackle it. What sort of takes you in that direction?
Well, you know, there are some stories that are fascinating to me that there's just no way to stuff that much storytelling into even long form television, and I've done some documentaries. It's tough to get it all in there. So something like what happened to the old American cities after the Second World War is a big, sprawling, complicated story with no right answers and a lot of memories, different memories of the experience that live in different people's heads. And that's what really turns me on about a story like that. The intertwining of politics and religion in the United States in the late 20th century had so many moving parts. and so many influential characters and has touched on so many different parts of our common life that that really appealed to me as a story, but it's very tough to tell either on radio or on television. So a book gives you an opportunity to really stretch out and tell a big, complicated story that rolls out over the course of decades. It works totally different muscles for a reporter. It forces you to think in totally different ways about how to tell a story and how to structure a story. I mean, it's the difference between eating a whole smorgasbord or just having a couple of snack peanuts from a bowl. It's just entirely different from taking one event that happened in one day in one city and on television that night say, here's what happened in 2.5 or 3 or 4 minutes.
Is there another book you're working on now, or is there something that's rattling around in your head that you're thinking needs to be tackled in book form?
Well, there are some things that I want to get started probably next year. When I first signed up with Al Jazeera America, it was part of company policy that correspondents should not be writing books. And I understand that. I understand why the policy existed. But I also think that my bosses now recognize the value in it because they saw me quoted and speaking and traveling when I was touring the Latino history book and saw a lot of value in that for having their name and one of the faces most associated with their network out in the country talking to audiences across the country. So I want to write a book about American politics. The toughest book, the one that I've wanted to write for the longest time, but would probably involve taking off work. These other books I wrote almost entirely while I was working full time. But I want to write a book about modern South Africa, and I really can't do that without going there for a long time. So I have one kid in high school. When she leaves home, I think I can actually start to think seriously about writing the book about the democratization of South Africa and what happened instead of a civil war and why a civil war didn't happen there, which to me is one of the great undertold stories of the second half of the last century.
Ray Suarez, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. Can't wait to come to Kalamazoo.
Ray Suarez is the host of Al Jazeera America's Inside Story. He's a former public radio and television host and the author of 3 books. The most recent is Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped a nation. I spoke with Ray Suarez earlier this month, and yes, he did make it to Kalamazoo and delivered the commencement address at Kalamazoo College on June 15th.
Thank you for this wonderful honor. It's a real treat to stand in the same esteem of this school as previous honorary degree recipients and commencement speakers, people like Thurgood Marshall, John Hope Franklin, William Sloan Coffin, Martin Marty, Milton Friedman, Dave Brubeck, and Arthur Ashe. To be included in this company is a heady thing.
This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Recently, 12-year-old Esteban Vertigo made the trip from Kalamazoo to Washington, D.C. While he was in the nation's capital, Vertigo was arrested. He was joined by his mother and other families who refused to leave House Speaker John Boehner's office. They demanded that Congress take up comprehensive immigration reform. Esteban Vertigo, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Tell the audience just a little bit about yourself. How old are you? You're 12, correct?
Yes, I'm 12 years old. I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
And where do you go to school?
I go to Washington Rises Academy. I just graduated from 5th grade.
So where will you go next year?
I will go to Maple Street Middle School.
So tell us a little bit about the decision to go to Washington, D.C. and to be arrested there.
I made the decision because people like my father... because about this week, my dad was deported. And it caused me to kind of have anxieties and grow up a little bit too quickly. And I just don't want people to go through what I did that day. What happened was it was really kind of devastating because I lost my fatherly figure. And I have my stepfather is undocumented also. And I don't want to lose him like I lost my father.
Your father was deported about a year ago?
Yes.
And your stepfather is, you say, undocumented as well. So is he in danger of being deported?
He could be, because almost every knock on the door could mean that they can come and take him.
You are a U.S. citizen, correct?
Yes, I was born in the United States.
Do you get to talk to your father at all?
Well, a few months ago, he communicated, but we weren't really sure where he is now because I tried messaging him on Father's Day saying, "Happy Father's Day, I miss you, Dad," and the message still hasn't been seen. So we're hoping for the best for my father, but we're not sure what happened.
Do you know where he went after he left the U.S.?
I know we went someplace in Mexico, but I think his present whereabouts are not known. Last time we communicated, he told me that he was at my grandmother's and that he was trying to find work in Canada.
So when you were arrested in Washington, D.C., how many people were with you at that time?
4 children were arrested, but in total, 18 people were arrested.
Were you treated well?
Yes, we were treated well, very well. They communicated with us. All that they practically did was have us sit in a room.
You didn't actually go into a jail cell then?
No, we didn't really go into a jail cell. It was kind of a holding chamber or something, because the jail cells look pretty bad. Because almost all of them were filled with a person, and the holding cell was open, so they put all 4 of us in the same cell.
How long were you there?
About 3 hours.
Did you actually get to speak to anyone from Speaker Boehner's office?
No, he had his door locked, and I felt like he was hiding from us.
How long were you there in front of his office before you were taken away?
Like 10 or 20 minutes. What they practically arrested us for was kind of obstructing the hallway or something. We were practically sitting in the hallway.
You knew when you went there, though, that was how it was going to end up, right?
Yeah, we knew most likely his office was going to be locked. And we always had we had a plan. We planned everything out as we did it. And my mom was very, very happy.
Very happy?
Mm-hmm.
Why was that?
She said that it was a time where a mother could actually be proud of her son getting arrested.
So what exactly, if you had the chance to speak to Speaker Boehner or a member of his staff, what would you have asked them to do?
I would ask the staff if they could tell the message to Speaker Boehner that we need immigration reform now. Wait anymore. We immediately need it, but we need to put the bill on the table for a vote.
And what would you want immigration reform to include? In other words, what sort of things should be in there so that a family doesn't go through what you're going through now, not knowing where your father is?
That they should probably legalize them in the United States so that they can get Social Security and stuff like that, because they could be denied that if they're an immigrant. And so my stepdad can probably get a lot more rights and actually ask for what he's worth, because he's being paid minimum at his job, but he's too afraid to ask for a raise even after all that he did for his boss. He did a lot of stuff like construction for his boss and a bunch of different things, but he's just afraid to ask for what he's worth.
Do you know other families that are in the same situation as yours?
Yes. I've heard of the lunch lady at my school. After she saw me on the news, she told me, thank you for sticking up for this, because she said that her daughter's father went through the same thing. Well, her daughter went through the same thing with her father. And my next door neighbor's parents are undocumented also. And they tell their kids to keep to themselves a lot, and they are really quiet about what they do because they just don't want to be noticed by ICE or anything. So they try to keep to themselves and just move on with it.
Did that a thought occur to you at all, that by going to Washington, D.C. and being arrested, you were making a very public statement at a time when, as you say, your stepfather could himself be deported?
Well, I really didn't give off names or addresses or anything, so I really couldn't be targeted for anything because they couldn't track me or anything unless they really wanted to look me up.
Are there kids at your school who understand what you're going through? I think immigration policy is something a lot of 12-year-olds don't give a lot of thought to unless they're actually involved in it. So I guess when you're talking to kids your age, is this something you talk about a lot?
Not really in my class because I'm kind of made fun of. But after I was on the news for like my last 2 days of school, they kind of treated me like, hey, this guy is my friend and stuff like that, because I was just on the news, but they probably didn't even understand the cause why I was on the news. They just understood that I was arrested and I was a little bit popular. But my best friend actually understands because his mother lost his father in immigration court because he was undocumented from Puerto Rico, and he tried. I guess he was just deported. He really hasn't told me about that, but he said that it was his closest fatherly figure that he had. So I could kind of relate to him, and I was a little bit happy that I could find somebody to relate to.
Do you plan to do anything in the future on immigration? Is there a next step right now?
I don't think I can answer that. I just participate in the actions. I'm not really informed unless it's like the day before.
But is it an issue that still interests you and something that you do plan to be active in the future?
Yes, it does. I'll be active in almost any action that they ask me to do if it involves immigration.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
I want to be a politician.
Don't run for Congress?
Maybe.
Well, you might be back in that chair again someday then.
Yep.
Esteban, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Esteban Vertigo is a 12-year-old from Kalamazoo. He was recently arrested in Washington, D.C. at House Speaker John Boehner's office, demanding that Congress take up comprehensive immigration reform. Links with more information and longer versions of the interviews on West Southwest can be found at WMUK.org. West Southwest is heard every Monday and Thursday morning at 9:20 on WMUK. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.